May it please the court, counsel, Peter Gregory on behalf of defendant appellant Matthew Hudson, registration number 10928. Generally, a party seeking to set aside a default judgment at the trial court level faces a rather steep climb. And generally, a party seeking appellate review of a denial of a motion to set aside a default judgment faces an even sharper incline. And yet, there are those unique circumstances where setting aside a default judgment is warranted. And Hudson submits that those circumstances exist here. One other preliminary point, if I might, and that is, as I make my argument, I would assert to the court that it's because of the facts, it's unclear that this particular fact situation fits nicely within 60B1, 60B2, or 60B2, and accordingly, the court will see that we move for relief under both 60B1, 60B2, and then the catch-all 60B5. The goal in my oral argument is to point out the unique circumstances of this case, some of the inconsistencies and errors in the trial court's ruling. As the court is aware from having read the briefs, this case has a long and complex history of transactions as reflected by Hudson's affidavit and the numerous exhibits which are attached. But to put what I believe the unique circumstances into context, let me give you some facts to build upon. We do know that in May of 2008, there were discussions between CEM and Larry Becker, who was a principal of an entity called Telemetrics. And an agreement was reached whereby CEM would loan to Telemetrics $750,000. In the context of that loan, it was required that there be personal guarantees by Larry Becker, his brother Warren Becker, and my client, Matthew Hudson. At the time those discussions were ongoing, Mr. Becker related a long history of deals and a relationship with Chuck Miller of CEM. And Becker made the statement to Hudson that CEM was likely to convert the note into an equity interest in Telemetrics. And I'm going to tie that point up in a moment. As the court knows from reading the briefs, after the abandoned attempt in late 2008 and early 2009 to bankrupt Telemetrics by Larry Becker, there was a transaction that took place in early 2009, about in the March timeframe. In that transaction, roughly $3 million of assets of Telemetrics were moved into the Green Eagle entities which had been formed by Larry Becker. What is critical and what gives this case a unique circumstance is that at that point in time, CEM was given a 30% stock interest in the Green Eagle entities for the sum of $300.
Did your client know about these transactions?
Those particular ones, I do not believe so, no. So, what happens is...
When did he find out about it?
I think he found out as we were going through setting aside the default judgment. Mm-hmm.
Because, and, counsel, the reason I ask the question is because these are all fascinating facts. They're wonderful defenses. But we're not here on an issue about whether he had a meritorious defense. The judge found he had meritorious, possible meritorious,
correct,
defenses. We're really here on two other prongs of the default judgment. A, was it reasonable, or was there excusable neglect for him not to appear in the case, knowing all this stuff? And the third prong, which is whether there's any, you know, prejudice and injury and the balancing of prejudice.
Right.
So maybe we should talk about why in the world did he not appear in the case that he had been served with in England, and he, I know the judge didn't put this in his opinion, but he is a solicitor. He is apparently a member of the bar there.
He is.
So why? What's the excuse for not appearing? What's the excuse?
That's actually addressed in the brief, and as the Supreme Court made clear in Goodman, the three factors are un, under 60B are not mutually exclusive. You consider each one of them and then balance them together. Let me get to your question in a roundabout way. First of all, in talking about the meritorious defense issue, really, it's more than a meritorious defense, and that's what makes the unique circumstances, and then I'll come to the excuse of neglect and the equities. Because what happened here was that when the suit was filed against Lauren Becker, Larry Becker, and Mr. Hudson, CEN moved for summary judgment against the Beckers, and the trial court entered a specific ruling denying summary judgment and found that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the note had been satisfied by that Green Eagle transaction. The argument that I would make to the court is this, and that is when we look at what the court considers a meritorious defense, and the Supreme Court in Goodman notes that it is a showing that is sufficient to demonstrate at least the possibility that a result following trial may be different. I would assert to the court that, in essence, a Rule 12 standard is like, is the defense you're asserting, does it hold water? What we have here
let
is
me,
a slight...
Let me interrupt you, and then I might for a moment. I think the ruling denying summary judgment was entered, if my chronology is right, November of 2011, maybe December.
November of 2010.
2010.
Right.
Was Mr. Hudson served with that order? Was he served with the motions? Was he aware of it?
No. He was not served because he'd not entered an appearance.
Therefore, he wasn't not appearing in the case even after November 2010. He could not have been relying on the court's ruling that there was dispute issues of fact, right?
I don't necessarily disagree with that. He could not have been relying because he didn't appear. But what makes this case unique, and I've not found any other case like it, is that you have a bona fide court order which says that under the elevated standard of summary judgment, as opposed to the Rule 12 standard, there were genuine issues of material fact based on the evidence which Larry Becker put forth concerning the transactions. So, when we look at the meritorious defense, that particular factor creates a very unique circumstance in this case. Now, turning to the excusable neglect, as set forth in the briefs, the reason that Hudson did not do anything was that he was in relatively constant communication with Larry Becker concerning trying to restructure Telemetrics in the 2010 and early 2011 time frame. And Becker made representations as to his relationship with CEM and what he could accomplish by dealing with Chuck Miller based on that relationship. And so our position, although it's not a dispositive factor, is that Mr. Hudson was in essence lulled into inaction through what Becker was saying. The interesting thing about the trial
was the essence. Are you saying the essence of what Becker is saying, that this case might be settled, therefore don't worry about it?
I don't know that he was going to say that the case was going to be settled, but as the court is aware, there's a lot of movement of money back and forth and transactions, and it appeared that there would be a restructure.
Okay. I read Mr. Hudson's very lengthy affidavit that you filed in support of his motion. I don't see anywhere in there that he says, I didn't appear in this case because I was relying on Mr. Becker to protect my interest. Even though that's your position, isn't it? But he doesn't say that in his affidavit.
He doesn't say that he was relying on Mr. Becker to protect his interest, but he does convey that based on the facts that were related to him by Becker, he thought things were going to resolve vis-a-vis the CEM note. And that's why he elected not to appear in this case.
And that's your position, that that's excusable neglect?
That is the position with respect to excusable neglect, correct. And our position, Your Honor, is that when we look at Goodman, which says you balance the factors, and you don't have to meet every one necessarily because it's now a balancing test, that the unique circumstance of that summary judgment ruling, which determined that the note may well, in fact, have already been satisfied through that Green Eagle transaction, is enough to set aside the default judgment. Now, couple of other points I want to point out before I run out of time here. When we look at the trial court's ruling, the trial court said, after acknowledging that he had denied summary judgment and found a genuine issue of material fact, the trial court, in denying the motion to set aside the default judgment, said, well, yeah, but the Beckers settled later. We would contend that that's an impermissible finding by the trial court because the law in Colorado is settlement doesn't amount to an admission of liability. There may have been many other reasons that the Beckers, in fact, settled, but the court seemed to make the leap that the settlement of the Becker part of the lawsuit meant that, indeed, the note was valid.
Well, maybe I misunderstood the court's order, so forgive me if I have, but I thought the court was saying, the trial court was, not that there was an admission of liability or the fact had been resolved, but the fact was no longer disputed before the court because the parties who disputed it no longer disputed it. They had settled it, and no current party was before the court disputing that fact. So whether it's true or not, it was not disputed anymore.
I'm not sure the court said that, Judge Navarro. At page 5 of 10, what I took was the court said, however, those two defendants later settled this case, which suggests that the Green Eagle stock transfer did not satisfy the note. That's at the bottom of page 5 of 10 of trial court's order.
Thank you.
And so it seems to me that he was really saying because of the settlement, they must have admitted liability. And so my prior fact that there is a genuine issue of material fact goes away. Two other points, if I might. First is the trial court finds that it was impermissible for Hudson to rely on Larry Becker because of the rather tumultuous relationship that they had, and yet, if we look at the facts that I tried to point out both in the brief and this morning, some of what Larry Becker said, if not a lot, seemed to be true, i.e., he put forward enough evidence that the note had been satisfied. There's factual evidence that suggests that the note was satisfied, and Becker had said in 2008 that CEM may well convert its note into an equity interest, which is what arguably happened. One more point before I sit down and reserve the remainder of my time, and that is the asserted error with regard to the entry of judgment for the full amount of the note. I believe that this court's decision in Cooper Investments versus Conger is directly on point, notwithstanding the trial court's attempt to distinguish it. Cooper versus Conger, which involved co-guarantors, joint and several liability on the notes. In Cooper versus Conger, the court said a creditor's release of a guarantor without the consent of the remaining guarantors discharges the remaining co-guarantors to the extent of their contributive share.
Didn't the judgment include that? Doesn't he get a credit? Doesn't Mr. Hudson get a credit for anything that's paid on the note by others under the judgment?
He gets a credit for what might be paid, but he doesn't get his liability reduced to the extent of their contributive share, which would be two-thirds. So the judgment should have been for one-third of the note and not the full amount of the note with amorphous credits depending on what got paid by the Beckers. That's the argument under the Conger case. If I may reserve my final minute.
I would like to ask one other question.
Yes.
In the Goodman case, the court mentions, it's not really the fourth factor, but it says prejudice to the moving party is something that we may consider or can consider. Prejudice to your client, in other words. Where's the prejudice to Mr. Hudson if we don't set aside the default judgment? My understanding is you claim he can't be, the judgment's unenforceable in England, so it's immaterial. Where's the prejudice to him based on that argument?
Well, I haven't necessarily claimed that the judgment is per se unenforceable in England. There are proceedings that are ongoing in England concerning enforcement. There's a question as to whether it's enforceable through a summary judgment proceeding. And in fact, the Queen's Bench has said, no, it's not. It may be enforceable through a separate full-blown proceeding on the Queen's Bench. But the prejudice is that we have a situation where ostensibly there's a genuine issue as to whether the note has been satisfied and judgment has been entered against him for the full amount of the note. My time's up. Thank you.
Counsel, I took about probably a minute of your time with my question that you didn't want to answer necessarily, but so we'll give you one more minute to respond, okay?
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Howard Hanel, registration number 11300. I'm counsel for Appellee Plaintiff CEM Associates, and Mr. Charles E. Miller, the principal of CEM Associates, is in the courtroom this morning. May it please the court. I wish to make 3 points for the court's consideration of whether the trial court acted within its discretion in denying Mr. Hudson's motion to set aside the default judgment. My 3 points relate to, one, Mr. Hudson's failure to have acted promptly once he knew the default judgment. Two, Mr. Hudson's failure to establish any semblance of fraud. And three, that Mr. Hudson's deliberate failure to defend CEM's claim, I think the record reflects that he deliberately failed to defend the claim, that in and of itself justifies the trial court's denial of any relief under his motion and under the standards of good. Of course, these points are made in the context of Mr. Hudson having had the burden of proof to show by clear and convincing evidence and by allegations of fact, not legal conclusions, that he was entitled to relief. So, my first point then is that Mr. Hudson did not act promptly once he learned on March 30, 2012, that the default judgment had been entered against him. The record is clear that it is CEM and Associates that advised Mr. Hudson, of the entry of the default judgment. And that happened on March 30, 2012, when CEM attempted to make a statutory claim against Mr. Hudson in England. On April 10, in reaction to that, Mr. Hudson threatened to file a motion to set aside the judgment. That was on April 10, but he waited another 77 days after he made that threat to file his motion to set aside the judgment on June 26, 2012.
Well, does the record reflect his threat?
Yes, it does. It's cited in the brief, my brief, page 25.
On that last point, counsel, are you suggesting that the motion was not prompt?
Yes, I am.
And what did the trial court find about that?
The trial court said that it was prompt because he filed within the 6-month limitation of Rule 60B1.
And so you're saying the trial court was wrong on that point?
Yes, Your
Honor. Okay. I didn't get that from your brief, I just wanted to clarify.
Okay. I said it in passing, and I think in light of the editor, I think that under Goodman, the court found that a wait of 2 months after knowing of a default was inexcusable as not being diligent. Excuse me. And earlier, the court said that waiting 6 weeks after the defendant knew that the plaintiff had undertaken collection efforts was a violation of the defendant's duty to act diligently in response to the default. So, yes, I respectfully suggest that the trial court, even though he found that Mr. Hudson had acted promptly because he acted within the 6-month limitation of Rule 60, I think under Goodman and Erlinger and other cases, Mr. Hudson did not act promptly.
Thank you.
Secondly, Mr. Hudson failed to meet his burden under 60B2, the fraud standard, by failing to show any relevant fraud. He was obligated to show fraud by clear and convincing evidence and using allegations of fact, not legal conclusions. And I think when Mr. Hudson's affidavit is read, it's full of legal conclusions, and that's all one can draw by it, in relation to Mr. Miller and CEO of Associates. He makes lots of specific allegations about Larry Becker and the Beckers and Telemetrics. What he then says, to tie all that up together, is he makes one simple statement that says that the Beckers did all these things and that CEM colluded with that. That's his entire factual allegation of holding CEM. So, Mr. Hudson, in his affidavit, admitted that he's never spoken to Mr. Miller and that he's never had any interactions with him. Mr. Hudson's allegations exclusively relate to what Larry Becker, his co-defendant, told him.
So, I'm sorry, so what you're telling us is that to the extent you could read any kind of fraud into his affidavit, it was fraud by the Beckers, not fraud by CEM, and the law requires that the fraud be by the judgment creditor,
correct,
and not by a co-defendant.
That's
correct. You're going to assert it under Rule 60B, I think it's 2, right?
Yes, that's correct. The trial court found that Mr. Hudson's allegations of fraud with respect to this fraudulent scheme that involves the Green Eagle shares and all that, the trial court found that it was not well pled. And the trial court also found that not only was it not well pled, but that every fact that Mr. Hudson alleged related to something that Larry Becker had told him. The court specifically found that incited from Mr. Hudson's affidavit, which I believe is a paragraph 20 of Mr. Hudson's affidavit, that Mr. Hudson admitted that he'd never spoken to Mr. Miller. So, those fraud claims failed for lack of being pled properly and for Mr. Hudson meeting his burden to establish any kind of fraud. But just as important, the fraud claims failed not only because they weren't well pled, but because there was no basis in the record. Mr. Hudson made no showing that anything about the fraud prevented him from entering appearance and from fully and fairly defending the claims that CBM had made against him. So, considering all of those fraud claims, the trial court applied a proper standard supported by Colorado law, the Southeastern Water District conservation case, and then the analogous federal cases under Rule 60B3 under the federal rules of procedure, which require that fraud must have prevented the movement from making a full and fair defense of the claims on which he was defaulted. And Mr. Hudson didn't even make an effort to establish any of those. So the court, as I said, found that he failed to establish any basis, factual basis for fraud. But then and this relates to some of the questions the court had. Mr. Hudson also raised a claim about this fraud on the court. And I would suggest that the record shows that the trial court also was correct as a matter of law in rejecting Mr. Hudson's fraud on the court claim. Now, the fraud on the court claim is offered under both 60B2 and 60B5 for his extraordinary circumstances. The claim for fraud on the court, again, is that CEM engaged in fraud by asking the court to enter a default judgment against Mr. Hudson when he was the only remaining defendant in the case, when previously the court had denied summary judgments to CEM based on there being a disputed issue of fact about whether or not the CEM note had been paid. So that's a fraud on the court claim. CEM was only the only party in the case at that point that had appeared. No other defendant was appearing. And although the court didn't articulate this, I think
the Beckers were the only party that had appeared as defendants.
Yeah, they had appeared and settled in
court. Right. Okay. You said CEM, I think.
Yes, excuse me.
Mr.
So, although this wasn't articulated by the court, this defense on fraud in the court fails because it assumes something about a summary judgment. It assumes that when the trial court denies a summary judgment that it means something. I don't think you need to cite any case. This is in reaction to the defendant Mr. Hudson's reply brief, which is full of references about how the trial court's denial of this summary judgment somehow imbued Mr. Hudson's co-defendants with the credibility. They say this repeated at pages 11 and 12 of their reply brief, that somehow or other the fact that the trial court accepted Larry Becker's affidavit to deny summary judgment, that somehow the court was making a finding of fact that then bound CEM on a subsequent effort or request that the default judgment be entered. So I think when a court denies summary judgment, the only thing that means is that the court has determined that the matter has to go to trial. It doesn't establish a fact. It doesn't do anything. It says that there are disputed facts that have to be tried and sorted out. Well, in this case, I think it's painfully obvious that Mr. Hudson waived his right to defend those claims. He didn't show them. So the fraud in the court, the summary judgment, I think, is a red herring. I don't think it means anything other than that the court decided there were disputed issues of fact at that point in the record, at that point in the case. The fraud in court also fails because it's just not possible to commit a fraud by failing to bring to the attention of the trial court a ruling that the trial court made. And also what the court said, and I think is also correct, it fails because nothing in CEM's conduct prevented Mr. Hudson from bringing to the trial court's attention all of the facts that he's now complaining about that were the premise for the denial of the summary judgment. He could have brought, had he appeared, could have brought the fact that Larry Becker had filed an affidavit and had testified, or at least made a statement under oath about the payment. He could have cross-examined, he could have done discovery, he could have done all those things. He didn't do any of that, and nothing that CEM did prevented him from doing any of those things.
Counsel, I want to turn to the third prong of Goodman, which is sort of the balancing of equities.
Yes.
Some of our case law says we want cases tried on the merits.
Yes, that's the first.
Other case law says we got to move it along.
Right.
Why do the equities favor here maintaining this default judgment?
All right. I think a couple of things. First of all, the balancing test in Goodman also does say, Robert, that there are certain cases where a failure of one of the factors can be so great that that factor alone justifies the denial of the motion for summary judgment. Goodman says that. So the weighing of the factors and the equitable considerations, promptness is, of course, one of those equitable considerations. And I think the record here is clear that Mr. Hudson was not prompt. The prejudice to Mr. Hudson is, I think, none, because he, every defendant has a prejudice that they don't want a judgment by default against them. So there's nothing extraordinary about the only prejudice he claims, which there's a default judgment against them. But the other aspect of this, and the record clearly shows this, is that CEM relied on the judgment. Now, on April 10, 2012, Mr. Hudson threatened to file a motion set aside. CEM waited another 25 days, and again, this is in the record, before it filed its collection action in England to attempt to enforce the judgment, to collect on the judgment. And it was a new suit that he had to file, and CEM filed.
So it was only after that was commenced that then the motion to set aside the default?
77 days. Well, actually, it would have been approximately 52 days, if my math is correct. So once we filed that lawsuit in England, it was another 52 days before Mr. Hudson filed the motion to set aside.
Despite having made the threat to do so sometime earlier?
Yes, on April 10th. So, and then, as an affidavit that was filed by Mr. Miller in response to the motion to set aside shows that CEM Associates, between April 10, the threat, and the June 26th filing of the motion to set aside judgment, CEM spent $64,000 attempting to establish and collect its judgment in England. Now, that's compared to the Goodman case, where the defendant filed a foreclosure action in the same district court that they had obtained the original judgment. Now, there's no fact in Goodman that says how much the plaintiff spent filing a foreclosure action. The record in Goodman, or the case in Goodman, shows that it couldn't have been much, because within 2 months of that, the defendant filed a stay of execution pending the resolution of his motion to set aside the default judgment. So the Supreme Court in Goodman found it compelling that the fact that the plaintiff had relied on the motion, on the default judgment, by filing the foreclosure action, that helped tip the equities in favor of the plaintiff and in favor of finality. So I think we have here that Mr. Hudson didn't act promptly, and that CEM Associates relied after having given Mr. Hudson notice of the judgment, notice of the default, and an opportunity to file his motion to set aside the judgment, it spent $64,000 attempting to collect the judgment anyway.
So on that point, counsel, can I get some clarification, hopefully? Is this enforceable, this default judgment?
In England?
Yeah, in the UK?
Yes, there's litigation that has to be had in England, but yes, it's enforceable. We do not have a treaty, the United States does not have a treaty with England. And so, basically, it's a civil claim. We have to file a claim in England to reprove all of this. Hmm. And then, of course, the court can survive some ethics, raise judicata, applies in English law, there's collateral estoppel, all of those issues apply, which is what I would suggest for today.
Let me ask another question. Does the Cooper case have any application here? Counsel says Cooper says the judgment's in the wrong amount. Counsel complains.
Yeah, no, I understand. No, this is not an appeal. Mr. Hudson gave up his right to appeal the trial court's judgment when he didn't appeal it, when he didn't appear. He didn't appear till, as a matter of fact, I think he knew about it before the time to appeal was expired. And yet he didn't appeal. Mm-hmm. So it's his own problem. And I've cited two cases in the brief that talk about a motion to set aside a default judgment is not an appeal. The court is not bound to review the record. The principle of finality is more important than a correct legal result. Under the circumstance we have here, where somebody had a fair opportunity to defend, didn't do it, was an excuse for not doing it, and the judgment should stay. So finality does say that you're not here to correct legal errors.
Okay, so you're saying Cooper might apply, but he never raised the Cooper defense. Therefore,
right.
He loses it.
Yes, okay. And the time to raise that was long, long past. So my last point, Your Honor, is I think the record does show deliberate neglect And I think if you look at the brief of Mr. Hudson, the opening brief at page 23, I think it was a deliberate strategy. And I'm going to quote from his brief, just one sentence. He said, Mr. Hudson, quote, knew he had no assets in the United States and that a foreign judgment could not be enforced against him without proceedings in England, meaning that a new lawsuit would have to be filed in England. Well, I would suggest that his delay, his intentionality is summed up right there. He intended not to defend because he didn't want to stand.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, I think you have about a minute left, I said. So, the law clerk, would you put a minute on the clock and give Mr. Gregory one more minute to respond?
That's there.
57 seconds. Wow. It's way more precise than I have.
Just a few points. With regard to proceeding promptly, I think what the court needs to do is look at the facts that gave rise to the motion to set aside the default judgment. It does take time to generate that affidavit that Mr. Hudson generated together with all of the exhibits. So he did move promptly and it was timely filed under the rules. Second,
but it wasn't filed till after proceedings in England were commenced against
him. That is correct, yes. Okay? Second, with regard to the fraud on the court, the issue there, first, we never really have alleged that CEM engaged, quote, in fraud, end quote. The allegation is slightly different, and the way it works is that the focus under Southeast Conservancy is on the use of the court as an instrument of injustice, which flows from the denial of the summary judgment indicating that the note may well have been satisfied. My time's up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course.